Greetings, fellow Homo sapiens, and welcome to the Symbiotic Podcast. This is the last episode of our third season of the podcast, and I'm really excited about our guest today. We'll be introducing him in just a minute. I'm Cole Hans from the Huck Institutes of the Life Sciences, and we're going to have with us today Dr. Zhaojun Lance Lian, who is in the Department of Biomedical Engineering, as well as the Department of Biology. He holds a dual position like so many Huck people do here at Penn State. And before I introduce him, and I'm very excited to do so, I just want to do a couple of housekeeping things for you. As you're watching, I encourage everybody to chat in and participate with us. There is a chat box either next to or below, depending on how you're viewing this. It'll be next to or below the screen. And you can be anonymous or you can share your name. Doesn't really matter. Make up your own name. We don't really care. But we do want you to participate. So please do participate in that chat. You can put your questions in there for Dr. Lian. And later on in the show, we will be taking those live and he'll answer your questions. And you can also vote on other people's questions. So we'll start with the highest voted questions at the end. This is about a 45-minute show here. We're going to be showing some video that we've been shooting and producing about the amazing work that Dr. Lian's doing with stem cells. We'll be sharing some of that, and we'll be doing some other fun audience participation stuff that you can vote on in the chat. So please do take advantage of that chat, and thank you for tuning in. So with that taken care of, Lance, hello.
Hello. Hey, Cole. Nice to be here. Nice to see you.
It's good to see you, too. It's been a little while. We were trying to have you on. Boy, it's been a couple months, and we ran into some problems here.
Right,
and
there. That's right.
Life can be like that. It can throw things at you between COVID and hiring issues and all sorts of things in our chaotic times. It took us a while, but we got here.
Right. Finally, we make this happen.
Yeah, that's the important thing, and we're very excited to have you here. You know, I was just mentioning the fact that you're in two different departments, which is such a Huck-like thing because Huck is all about interdisciplinary collaboration. And we were just discussing before we started the show here that the work you're doing is a beautiful combination. It's a place that you can serve both biology and biomedical engineering. Can you tell us a little bit about that before we get into other things?
Sure. I was appointed by biomedical engineering and biology department. That's because my lab research is focused on stem cell engineering and stem cell biology. That's a very natural thing for me to be appointed by these two departments, and I can contribute to both departments in different ways.
And you were saying even some new courses are emerging out of that reality, right?
That's right. Since I joined Penn State, I developed a cross-listing course which is called Stem Cell Biology and Therapy. So this course is open for both BME students and biology students. So during this course, I assign projects to students. So in this way, engineering students and biology students have the opportunity to work together for one project. So engineering students are more good at quantitative biology, such as use calculus and math to solving things, and biology knows better for biological mechanisms. So when I put them together, they can learn from each other, and this is more productive than just a group of engineering or students work together.
That's fabulous. I mean, that's what we're all about at Huck. So kudos to you, my friend. Thank you for doing that. It's exactly the kind of thing that we're championing, and I think the big complicated issues that we're grappling with, whether it's medical or environmental or even economic, you could go on and on with all the different challenges we're up against these days. But it really does take different kinds of people thinking different ways to take that on. So thanks for your contributions there. And then, of course, with your research, it's just fabulous. The amount of innovations, we'll get to those in a minute with what you're doing with stem cells. Just working with you on the video, I've learned so much and I'm still learning and there's no end. So that's why we have you on here in our Risk Taker Game Changer series as this great end to the season. It's a strong ending with you because there's so much to share that we'll be talking about. But before we get into the science, I do this with every guest of this season. I want to know a little bit about you, Lance. And you chose the name Lance, right? Zhaojun is your name. You were born in yeah. China, and kind of took this nickname when you came here to the States. So I want to know, Zhaojun, when you were growing up, when you were a kid, were you a risk taker? Were you somebody who always changed things and weren't just satisfied with the status quo?
Right. Yeah. So I was born in a small town in China, in Jiangsu province. So when I grew up, I'm definitely like to take risks. So for example, if I do hiking, I would like to go through these passes that no one else goes before. So the reason for that is because if you go these passes, you will see unusual, beautiful things that, you know, as compared to you use, you know, the passes that everybody goes. So, and I like to see unexpected things, and especially, you know, for doing the research, you know, I don't want to do something that everybody is doing. I want to go through, you know, these passes that no one does before. And, you know, I enjoy a lot about taking risks.
That's fantastic. I love that. I also love to go where there is no path. Yeah. Try and find a path, right? I have a quote on the wall at home. It says, do not go where the path may lead. Make your own path, set your own path and make a trail for others to follow. I definitely relate. That's terrific. And Lance, why did you choose the name Lance? Was there any particular reason that you went with Lance?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, in China, when we grew up, we take English classes when we were in the middle school. So, and then usually, you know, the teachers will ask you to pick an English name for yourself. And I started to think about it. And I was like, okay, I want to pick a name. You know, by that time, I just started to learn English. And I want to start with the letter L, because my family name is L. Okay. I think it would be cool if I got two L.
Yeah.
And then I just look at, you know, these English books. And I find that when I see Lance, and I really like it. So that's why I just picked this one. Yeah.
It just appealed to you. And Lance Lian, it does sound good.
Right.
It flows. Yeah, the
that's
two
right.
L's. I love that. Terrific. Well, Lance Lian, let's talk about your research a little bit here. You've done so much with stem cells, and you've taken some risks with stem cells. We'll be watching this in the video in a moment. And one of the things I learned working with you was about this Wnt pathway that we're going to be talking about a little more. Right. And maybe you could share with us one of the many innovations that hope we'll touch on is that there are many different ways to differentiate stem cells, and there are many different pathways for the differentiation. But you had shared with me that many scientists working with stem cells try to work across maybe 10 different pathways and trying to figure out all of them. And you chose one. I see that as a big risk that you took.
Right.
You chose one single pathway, the Wnt pathway.
Right.
And went deep on that, and it really yielded all sorts of incredible innovations and breakthroughs. Can you speak about what made you choose that one pathway?
Right. So, you know, stem cells, the stem cell type that we are working on is called pluripotent stem cells. So naturally, you know, if you have the embryo, if you have the stem cells, and in the mother's uterus, you know, these cells just naturally differentiate into all different type of cells in our body. So if you examine what signaling pathways, what signaling factors involved in this differentiation, you will find there are more than 20 different cell signaling pathways.
And 20? Oh, I was saying 10. There's
yeah,
more than 20
yeah,
yeah,
more
signaling
than 20.
Pathways.
And if you check how many, you know, signaling factors involved, because each signaling pathway may have multiple signaling factors, you may end up with 100 factors. There are just so many things involved in this process. So when we do this, you know, in the petri dish, in the lab, if we try to 100% recapitulation of what's going on in vivo, that is almost impossible because there are just so many factors involved in this process. And if you want to optimize concentration for each of them, you may end up with a combination of billions of combinations. You can never do billions of dishes for experiments, right?
Right.
So what I do is, so my logic is, how about we find the most critical one? And if we systemically optimize this most critical one, can we yield similar results as compared to optimization of many of these factors?
I see.
To be honest, that's definitely a risk for me, because it is quite possible that just optimize one signaling pathway may not work at all. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in nature, you need so many different factors. And here, you just try to optimize just a single one pathway and hope it's going to work.
Yeah.
So I think, I take the risk, and I did a lot of work. It took me about 4 years, and it turns out it worked. So I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I think there's also a little bit of lucky components here, but it indeed worked.
You did it. Yeah, a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work and sweat. Yeah. I mean, we talked about the hours that
right.
you had to run these experiments over those about 4 years, did you just 3-4 years?
Right, in total, took me about 4 years.
About 4 years. And during the 4 years, because time is such an important element, right?
Right.
That you people going in 3 a.m, checking on
right.
things, just watching 24/7. And just trying this, trying that, and,
right.
and just doggedly
right.
going forward.
Right.
And so when you say it worked, check me if I'm wrong here, Lance, if I'm misconstruing anything. But my understanding is that not only did you create a process for differentiation of stem cells into the other cells that you're trying to make,
right.
but you're doing it cheaper, you're doing it faster, and you're doing it with a lot greater efficiency, correct?
That's right. That's right. So the differentiation that we are talking about is called cardiac differentiation. So the goal here is we want to convert stem cells into cardiac myocytes. The reason for that is because cardiomyocytes are very critical for our heart function. And if a person have a heart attack, their cardiomyocytes died. And if we can generate these cells in the lab, we can potentially transplant these cells back into the heart failure patient. And indeed, this is happening. And during the time that I'm doing my PhD, and the cardiac differentiation efficiency is very low. So you do the differentiation, and it took you about 3 to 4 weeks, and your yield is about like 1-2%. So the efficiency is very low. So my methods greatly improved the efficiency. We can generate more than 90% of the efficiency, and we can achieve our goals in about 10 days. So we both shorten the time, and also we greatly improve the efficiency.
And then the cost associated
That's
with that
right.
process too dramatically reduced, correct?
That's right. So the previous approaches use the serum and growth factors to do the differentiation. And these factors are expensive and not stable. So that's why you have to use these growth factors, you know, more quickly. You cannot store them for a long time. And instead, I did not use any serum. I did not use any growth factors. I used 2 small molecule compounds to do it. So these chemical compounds are more stable and much, much cheaper. So the cost of these chemical compounds is only 5% of the growth factor cost. So if they need $100 to do the differentiation, I only need $5 to do it.
That's fantastic. That's something that we do share in the video. We'll be showing a sneak preview here in just a minute of a video about the cardiomyocyte work you're doing. It also mentions pancreatic beta
right.
cells that are producing insulin. So before we run the clip, let's hear a little bit about that. And which came first, the cardiomyocytes or the pancreatic beta cells? And also, I'm curious, is the same process you developed for cardiomyocytes, which are heart cells, is that's the same process then you're using to produce pancreatic beta cells, correct? And it has to do with the amount of activation and deactivation of the Wnt pathway, correct?
Right, that's right. So cardiomyocytes differentiation happens first. So during my PhD, so I developed this robust protocol for generating cardiomyocytes. Essentially, we can generate beating cardiomyocytes across the whole dish. And later, after I joined Penn State, I started to think about, you know, what type of projects that I should work on at Penn State. You know, because the cardiomyocytes efficiency is already great. So there's not much room for me to further improve it. And so I decided to look around and see which other cell types are clinical relevant and also very difficult to generate. So I like to take the risks. You know, if no one else can do this very efficiently, I want to do it. I want to make it better. So then I pick the pancreatic beta cells. The reason for pancreatic beta cells is they are very, very useful cells for treating type 1 diabetes. So these type 1 diabetes patients, their own pancreatic beta cells died because their beta cells are under attack by their immune cells. So basically, their immune cells kill their beta cells. So they do not have beta cells. They cannot naturally control their blood glucose concentration. That's why they have the diabetes. So in this case, the stem cell therapy is very good for treating this disease, because if we can generate good amount of functional pancreatic beta cells, we can transplant these cells back into these type 1 diabetes patients. We can potentially cure the disease as compared to if you just do insulin injection, you just treat the disease. So that's why, you know, in Penn State, you know, I decided to work on this. And it turns out, very, very surprisingly, that you can still use the Wnt pathway to regulate the stem cells to generate the pancreatic beta cell progenitors by adjusting the amount of activation. So if you activate the Wnt pathway with higher concentration of the chemicals, you generate cardiomyocytes. But if you activate the Wnt pathway at the intermediate level, you generate the pancreatic progenitors. So that's very surprising.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, nobody reported that before.
Now, what about neurons? Because I know that neurons are a third very important cell that cannot be produced by the human body, right? We can produce skin cells and many different cells. We've talked about this, you and I, and but heart cells and pancreatic beta cells and neurons are a third. Would you be able to produce neurons then with the same process?
Yeah, that's a great question. And based on the literature, you know, my lab didn't work on a lot of neuron differentiation. But based on the literature, it is very interesting that the Wnt pathway is also involved in neuron differentiation. But in this case, you must suppress the Wnt pathway in order to do the neuron differentiation. Yeah. So in summary, you can regulate one signaling pathway and generate three different types of cells. If you suppress the Wnt pathway, you got neurons. If you intermediate activate the pathway, you got pancreatic progenitor. If you highly activate the pathway, you got cardiomyocytes.
Fantastic. Amazing. It's a good thing you went to look for a new path in the scientific woods there.
Right.
Yeah. Really found some beautiful things in the process. Let's take a look at our video if we can. This would be a nice time. And I want to encourage everybody to chat in with your questions. I'm trying to watch the chat over here so that we have some things to answer later on in the conversation. But right now, let's take a look at a sneak peek. This is 3 minutes of a video that, when it's done, will be probably about 5 minutes. Let's take a look now.
The human heart is made of cardiomyocytes, specialized pulsing muscle cells. Without them, our hearts can't beat. Unfortunately, unlike many other kinds of cells in our bodies, cardiomyocytes don't naturally regenerate. That's one reason why heart disease is the number one cause of death in the United States. It's also the reason that stem cell therapy is considered the most promising treatment for repairing damaged heart tissue. As the raw material from which our bodies are made, stem cells have the incredible potential to form new cardiomyocytes, or any other kind of cell. But these cells can only be therapeutically viable if we can control what kinds of cells they become, and successfully introduce them into a patient's body.
In total, for human body, we have about 200 different type of cells. And now we can generate at least 50% of these cells. So around like 100 different type of cells from stem cells. But many researchers are focusing on these cell types that cannot be regenerated naturally by our human body.
Lance Lian is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at Penn State.
The hottest areas are three different types of cells. They are neurons, cardiomyocytes, and the pancreatic beta cells.
At its outset, stem cell research was hugely controversial. When biologist James Thompson derived the first human stem cell line in 1998, he started with cells sampled from human embryos. In 2001, President George W. Bush banned funding of any new embryonic stem cell lines. But in 2006, Japanese researcher Shinya Yamanaka discovered that adult cells could be reprogrammed to become stem cells, an advance that won him a share of the 2012 Nobel Prize in Medicine and removed the need for embryos. With stem cells readily available to labs, researchers began to discover multiple methods to drive cell differentiation and obtain specific types of cells needed to advance new cell therapies.
Once you have iPS cell lines, one of the properties of these iPS cells is they can proliferate almost indefinitely. So then you do not need to worry about the number of cells that you can have.
Lian and his team have devised a novel way to produce new cardiomyocytes by manipulating the Wnt pathway, a sort of protein-based communication network used by cells. By timing specific activations and inhibitions of this pathway, the Lian lab has advanced the effectiveness of stem cell differentiation from the highly random 1% yield produced by older methods to yields as high as 90%. They've also reduced the time it takes to produce cells, from a month to around 10 days, and they've reduced the cost of the process by 99%.
We published our paper, and now our methods become like a gold standard methods in the field, you know, for all the other labs around the world if they want to make cardiomyocytes.
In addition to cardiomyocytes, Lian's lab has used their differentiation technique to make pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin, a breakthrough that may lead to new therapies for type 1 diabetes.
Well, I hope you like what we did so far, Lance.
I really like it.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad. Yeah, we had a lot of fun coming out to your lab and shooting and the real stuff. There was no faking going on there, right? That was real science happening right in front of us. And it's beautiful to capture that. It seems like magic in a way, stuff that's going on. So what we didn't get to in that video yet that we're going to get to is actually, it's funny, somebody just chatted in with a question. So I'm going to take this first question here because it fits right in with another thing I wanted to touch on. David H. says, hello, senior biology major here at PSU. When the artificial pancreatic beta cells are administered to type 1 diabetics, will these patients' immune systems attack these new cells? And that's what we were just about to talk about. It'll be in the video later. We're talking about universal donor cells. Let's talk about that.
Sure. You know, that's a great question. You know, thank you for the question. So when we generate the pancreatic beta cells in the lab and then we transplant back into the patient, the patient's immune cells may still attack our transplanted cells. So the question here is, how do we protect our transplanted cells? So there are two ways that you can do it. The first way is use a gene editing approach that we can generate the so-called universal donor stem cell. So these universal donor stem cells, we locked out the genes associated with immune interaction with immune cells. So the immune cells will not treat our transplanted cells as foreigners.
You locked them out. You locked out. You found those genes that would cause the immune system to react.
That's
right.
You
locked them out.
I locked them out with the CRISPR gene editing technology.
CRISPR.
Yes. So in this way, the immune cells, such as T cells, will not attack our transplanted cells. So the stem cell-derived pancreatic beta cells can survive in vivo for many years. Okay, that's one way to protect the transplanted cells. Mm-hmm. The second way to protect the transplanted cells, which is also going on in clinical trials nowadays, that is you use specific polymers to make the scaffold to encapsulate the beta cells. Mm. So these encapsulation device have small tiny holes on the surface, but these holes are small enough. They can only allow the insulin to come in and out, insulin glucose, these small molecules to come in and out. They do not allow cells to come in and out.
Wow.
So the immune cells know their foreigners are inside of the device, but they just cannot get in to attack them. So in this way, you protect the transplanted pancreatic beta cells.
Very interesting. Polymers. We're talking nanotechnology here. That's a very, that reminds me of the whole convergence world of materials and,
that's right.
And life sciences.
Yeah. Nowadays, you know, many of these researchers, many of these problems that we are facing are extremely difficult to solve. So that's why we have to work with both biologists, you know, biomedical engineers, and material scientists. We work together to solve this big problem.
Right on. And if we return back to the method you developed for the pancreatic beta cells to be donor cells, let's also touch on the fact that it's not just pancreatic cells we're talking about. We're talking about all of them, right? We're talking
That's
about
right.
the cardiomyocytes as well. So like if people watching this think about a heart transplant,
that's right.
And that's always a problem is you put the new heart in, but will the body reject that heart? And the same thing is happening on a cellular level with these differentiated stem cells, the cardiomyocytes into the, say like a heart attack victim, like a patient who can't, like the body can't regenerate, just like it says in the video, they can't regenerate these cells. But if you put the cells in, that's another instance where the body could reject them. But this process you've developed with CRISPR and sort of tricking it, it's almost like stealth cells,
right?
That right. are not rejected. And you had shared with me that since you published that paper and put the method out there, which is patented, by the way, right?
Right.
Now there are clinical trials going on right now in three countries, correct? With heart patients
right.
who are using these universal cardiomyocyte cells that derived using your methodology, correct?
You know, for the stem cell nature, you can use two different type of cells, right? One is called embryonic stem cell. Mm. So another one is called induced pluripotent stem cell, iPS cells. Mm. So for the cardiac therapy, if we use patient's own cell, so for example, we take a little bit of their skin biopsy and generate iPS cells and then generate a cardiac cell. If you transplant these cardiac cell back into the same patient, you may have much less concern about immune rejection. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is because the cells are coming from their own skin cells.
Ah.
So in this case, you may not even need the universal donor stem cell.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, in this case, in this specific case.
Got it.
But for pancreatic beta cell, even you use patient's own cell to do iPS cell generation, to do beta cell differentiation, and a transplant back, you may still have the problem.
Oh.
Because the patient, their immune cells just attack their own cell. So these are a little bit different. So for example, if we take the cardiomyocytes as an example, why cardiomyocytes, we may still need the universal donor stem cell. Why not we just customize iPS cells for individual patients? The reason for that, it will be the reason why the cost will be extremely high.
Mm.
That is, every time I got a new patient, I have to generate a specific iPS cell line for that patient, and then I need to do differentiation. I cannot make the off-the-shelf product.
Got it.
The reason, too, in some acute situations, for example, heart failure, you don't have time to do that. So the patient come to hospital, and they may die in 4 to 5 hours.
Right.
You cannot just say, like, wait, I need to generate iPS cells, and that take about 1 month.
Right.
The patient just didn't have time for you to do that.
Yeah.
So then also for business and, you know, these pharmaceutical companies willing to do this, they don't want to do personalized medicine because that cost is just too high. Just no one can afford it. But if you can generate a universal donor stem cell,
yeah.
and then you can generate billions of cardiomyocytes, and then you freeze in the liquid nitrogen tanks, and it's kind of like the off-the-shelf product. Yeah. The patient comes to the hospital, you immediately saw one vial of the cells, and then you do the transplantation. That is a more feasible business model to do this.
That's phenomenal. And I know that you do have some industry partners, and you been working with some IP. Do you want to talk about that? I know it's an important thing for Penn State, and one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is to tell some stories to others in the community
sure.
who may want to do similar things. So could you speak about what that experience has been like for you?
Sure. So since I joined Penn State, my lab has filed through Penn State 5 to 6 patents. So they are covered, you know, different things. So for example, one patent is focusing on how to generate pancreatic beta cells from stem cells. You know, another one is related to how to generate these universal donor stem cells. You know, of course, we can combine these two patents together to generate the so-called universal donor beta cells, right? But the universal donor stem cells has more broad applications than just beta cells. If you use universal donor stem cell to generate cardiac cells, to generate neurons, these cells after transplantation will also not be rejected, you know, by the patient's own immune cells, right? So that's why, you know, we are very interested in combining the universal donor stem cell and pancreatic beta cell protocol together. And then we start a new company. And then I work with a business partner from New York, and we try to recruit the funding to support our company. And then we try to push this forward for clinical trials using these universal donor beta cells for therapy.
Fantastic. I love it. Now I'm checking my notes because you've done some other things well, even on top of that. When we talk about where stem cells come from, I want to make sure we touch on this too. In the little video that we showed, there's a kind of a quick and dirty little timeline there of, you know, embryonic stem cells were where this all began.
Right.
And it was very controversial because people talk about the cells from embryos and the ethical dimensions of that. But then we were able to take these from adult humans. But you've taken it even further to the point where you don't even need blood or a biopsy. Just from a urine sample, you're able to derive cells?
That's right. So, you know, I really want to talk about this topic because many times the audience may think, you know, all the stem cells are the same, but they are not. So we have the embryonic stem cells. They must derive from human embryos. So that's why, you know, they are ethically debatable. So that's why, you know, different people have different ideas on these cells. But the induced pluripotent stem cells do not need any embryos. We can use the adult person's skin cells, blood cells. But if you think about it, these processes are still painful, right? So you needed to draw, you know, some of the blood, or you needed to donate some of the skin biopsy. So at Penn State, I decided to generate our own induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, you know, for our lab. And we think about it. We were wondering, what about we just, you know, take the cells from the urine samples? So we did that. You know, we take some urines, you know, from one of our lab member, and then we applied the IRB through Penn State. You know, Penn State agreed with our approach, and we spin down the urine, and then we collect the cells. So you got about like 10 cells out of 100 ml of the urine samples. A lot of cells, just 10 cells. Mm-hmm. But the good news is these cells, once they attach to the Petri dish, they can proliferate.
Right.
They can, you know, one cell become two become four become eight. And then, you know, after 10 days, we got about like a couple thousand cells.
Wow.
And then starting from these cells, we use a reprogramming technology developed by Dr. Seiyang Yamanaka, you know, who won the Nobel Prize in 2012. And then we use similar technology and reprogrammed the urine cells, you know, to iPS cells. So this process that developed by us is a non-painful process at all, because we just need to collect a little bit of urine samples.
Right.
That's which, it.
And the people who can collect a urine sample versus, you know, the training it takes to draw blood or get
that's
it,
right.
Know, so there's more. There's also the cost and the time and the effort. And so, again, you're changing the game. I mean, in all these different dimensions of stem cell engineering and stem cell differentiation and even the sample collection.
Right.
It's quite phenomenal. So what the heck are you working on next, Lance? What's on your agenda right now?
Yeah, great question. So in my lab, you know, we talk a lot about stem cells. Actually, in my lab, we also work on gene editing.
Gene editing.
Yeah. Let me explain why gene editing and stem cell research are a very good match. So, you know, there are many, many patients that have diseases because they inherited the disease-causing mutations from their parents.
Right.
Yes.
Hereditary.
So that's why, you know, we are very dedicated to develop gene editing technologies to correct these mutations in the patients. Mm-hmm. So recently, my lab published a new paper in Cell Reports Methods. We showed that we can greatly improve the gene editing efficiency by using the so-called chemical and modified RNA. So this is a technology that used to generate the SARS-CoV RNA vaccine.
Mm.
So we use this modified RNA technology to encode gene editing enzymes. And we find this method is much higher efficiency as compared to traditionally, you know, people use DNA to encode these effectors. So our efficiency can achieve about like 85%, and the traditional efficiency is only 10 to 15%.
Did you say modified ions?
Modified RNA.
RNA. Yeah, I'm just making sure. Okay, RNA. Right. That makes sense because we've all heard about RNA with,
that's
as you
right.
said, the COVID vaccines.
RNA vaccine,
so,
that's right.
So now we're completely moving away from stem cells altogether, right?
But
you bring it back into the stem cell realm.
Not moving away from stem cells. Let me explain why this is still closely related to stem cells.
Okay.
Because if you have a patient, that patient has a mutation, you can take that patient's urine cells and make iPS cells. So the iPS cells will have the same mutation as a patient cell because this is from the patient.
Got it.
So it has a mutation.
Okay.
The question here is, how do you correct the mutation? You cannot directly test your gene editing in the patient, but you can test with iPS cells derived from the patient.
Oh.
That's why it's a perfect match.
Wow.
So
yes.
This is okay. what we are working on in the lab.
Wow.
So we take the patient's urine cells, make the patient's iPS cell, and we deliver the gene editing into the iPS cell. And we want to see if we can correct the mutation. Yeah, I already received many emails actually from different patients asking me to see if we can help them for this type of disease. Yeah.
Phenomenal. It's got to be a lot of fun working in your lab.
Yeah, we always work on, you know, different new projects and, you know, and take the risk steps. Yes.
Yeah, never a dull moment. That's how it is around Huck and a lot of the Huck labs. Never a dull moment. Well, boy, we're coming up pretty quick on time. I'm surprised at the number of questions I'm not seeing, and I don't know if that's because something's malfunctioning on my end with what I'm able to see on my screen. But I'm going to try one more time to check in. Oh boy, okay. So there is a follow-up question here. Okay, I just had to refresh. What are your goals for the clinical application of generated neurons? Are you looking to treat any conditions in specific at this time, any specific conditions?
Right, great question. So my lab actually didn't work a lot on the neurons, but talking about iPS cell-derived neuron application, I think one of the biggest applications would be related to stroke.
Stroke.
So, yes, stroke. You know, let me make an analogy. You know, in the heart failure causes the cardiomyocytes to die. The stroke caused the neurons to die.
Yes.
So basically, if you can generate iPS-derived functional neurons, you can also transplant these neurons to replace the damaged neuron area.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can have the new neurons grow in that area.
That's phenomenal. That could just be a whole new world, medically
right.
speaking. Well, it's fantastic. I'm so glad. I'm checking to make sure did I miss anything? We talked about patents. We talked about clinical trials. We talked about what's next: cheaper, faster, more efficient. Getting stem cells from urine samples, Wnt pathways, insulin producing pancreatic beta cells, neurons. You know, you're all over. And now CRISPR as well. We're going deeper into CRISPR and addressing some of those mutations as well. Phenomenal. So there's only really one thing left to do on this episode, Lance, and that is to talk a little bit about our plushies over here.
Sure.
I can't let you go without talking about our plushies.
Yeah.
We've done this all through our entire third season with our Risk Takers and Game Changers. It's just our way of having a little fun. And we're doing our own little research, Lance. I'm researching people like you,
sure.
These phenomenal risk takers and game changers in science. And I'm trying to find out how you compare if I give you, it's a social science experiment. If I show you these alternative plushies, we've got a unicorn over here. Dan's going to show our little video so that our audience can really get a good look at these. Let's take a look, Dan, if you can run that clip. We'll really show this off. There we go. It's 2022, people, and we can go deeper into plushie land than just the usual Nittany Lion that everybody's used to. Everybody loves the Nittany Lion. We love them, but you know, if you're not a lion person, you could go with a Nittany Unicorn. You could go with a Nittany Little Bear. I like to call that the infant indoctrination bear. If you have little ones in your life that you want to get into the Penn State community. We also have the old gnome in the middle there, for watch over your garden and keep the Penn State vibes going. We even have a llama, and they all get along. With our lion, you can see the lion right there. And by the way, I heard the lion's in a 12-step program now, so we're all very, very happy with the lion. He's making up with everybody in his life, doing all his good work and getting his life together. But so I want to ask you, what's your favorite alternative plushie, Lance? Do you like are you a unicorn man, a bear man, a gnome, or a llama?
Right, great question. So my top one choice is for sure go with Little Lions, okay, because I'm Penn Stater. So the second choice I would go is this, the unicorn.
The unicorn would be your favorite alternative.
Yeah, the reason for that is because unicorns are associated with dreams.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I in China we saw many descriptions about unicorns with dreams. I just hope that, I'm a person that want to dream big, want to do, risk things. So that's why I like unicorns very much.
I love that. I like the unicorn too. That's phenomenal. So everybody out there watching, before you sign off here, please vote. You can go in the chat right there. You can vote llama, gnome, bear, unicorn. And then what we're going to do is we're going to compile all the data. We're looking at which scientists liked which plushie, and then which the audience members of the different scientists, how did the audiences break out? And then we may start our own journal. We're thinking about starting a journal, social science journal, just called Plushie. And this will be our first paper. And we'll see. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to apply that to anything practical, but maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's just something fun for us. But in all seriousness, Lance, thanks so much for coming down and sharing a little bit about what you're doing. It's phenomenal. Thank you. You're one of the reasons that Penn State is great, is people like you doing the work and inspiring the next generation and collaborating with colleagues across disciplines to really make a difference in the world. So thank you very much. More power to you as you go forward. If people want to follow Lance's work, keep up with the Huck, you could subscribe to our newsletter, The Pulse, at our website, and you'll be getting updates about what Lance is doing and others at the Huck. I encourage you to do that. Also, if you subscribe to our YouTube channel, when we finish our video about Lance's work, that's our Life from All Angles video, the whole thing, you'll be able to watch that and share it with others. This episode will be on the YouTube channel as well. So if somebody missed this and you think they ought to see it, pay attention there. You can share it with others there. We're also going to be releasing our video about Dr. Sally McKenzie. We never finished off. There was an animation we're just finishing up. So her video is also forthcoming. So stay tuned for that. And we're going to take a hiatus from the Symbiotic Podcast. We're taking a little break and we're going to come back with something totally different in the new year. So, stay tuned for that. But again, Lance, thank you so much for coming down. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Cole. Nice to be here.
Take good care. And everybody out there, thanks again for watching and don't stop co-evolving.
The Symbiotic Podcast is a production of the Huck Institutes of the Life Sciences at Penn State University. Our video and live stream producer is Dan Lesher. Our web developer is Jody LeMaster, and our marketing manager is Keith Hickey. Cole Hans hosts and directs the show, and original illustrations and animations are provided by Sam Muller and Bethany Seed. If you enjoy our podcast, we hope you'll subscribe and share it with others. We'd also love to know what you think about our content, so if you want to get in touch, please email symbiotic@psu.edu.